This is part two in a series of Tuesday night classes. This is called Vedic Knowledge. The Tuesday night classes differ from the Sunday classes, inasmuch as the Sunday classes are for newcomers. And they also present practical solutions to problems living in the everyday world, things that topical ideas that people can apply on Monday morning. The Tuesday night classes are more a membership class. People have taken steps in Krishna consciousness, and the Tuesday nights are more matter-of-fact type presentations, just to deliver the nuts and bolts, you know, the ins and outs, the practical aspects of Krishna consciousness. We're doing a series on science, and these slides have been put together very expertly by Radhe Shyam, the president of Pune Temple. He has a preteen outreach program to businessmen and to scientific community that's incredibly successful. And we're just following its footsteps here. As I said, this has to do with Vedic knowledge. And last week in the first part, we talked about how every animal, every species has something unique, some unique ability or mystic power, some way to defend itself, whether it has armor like the turtle or the armadillo, whether it can fly like the bird, whether it can sleep like the bear, whether it can swim like the fish. Every single species has something it can do uniquely. And when you think about it, the human can't compete with any of them on any of those physical levels. I mean, on one level, we're probably the least gifted, the least talented, the least adult. We have the least abilities of any species, except for the fact of our intelligence. And that intelligence can be used for good or it can be used for ill. We have rational thought capacity. The animals also have rational thought capacity, but ours can expand into abstract areas. Who am I? Where have I come? What is the problem? What is the purpose of life? Why am I suffering? How I can address myself and solve those problems of suffering? These are areas that an animal could never venture. They have rationality as far as eating, sleeping, mating, defending, but they don't have the ability to venture into these kinds of areas of inquiry. So this is what we're made for. Just like the bird, the sparrow is made to fly, the bear is made to sleep, the tiger is made as a lethal killing machine, we're made to gather knowledge, to apply that knowledge, and to solve the suffering problems of life. We've already done this in many mundane ways. So yellow fever no longer exists because scientists acquired knowledge as to the cause of yellow fever, and then they eliminated smallpox. Many diseases have come and gone because of the accumulation of knowledge. We had a seniors tour earlier today, and after the presentation, I asked her questions. And one lady says, well, what do we do with all this wisdom? What do we do with it? You know, what do we do with it? And I said, well, mundane wisdom you use to solve short-term problems, to bring about solutions to short-term problems, like various types of diseases. The only problem with that is that when you solve one problem in the mundane world, another one comes up. You can't make this a utopia. You can't make this the kingdom of God because it's created for a different purpose. In the same way that the prison house is created for reforming the bent mentality of the criminals, we are put here as spirit souls to undergo a learning reformation process. And part of that character building process has to do with suffering. You know, it's not all rosy here in the material world. There are tests, there are trials, there are things that we're going to encounter and things that we're going to learn that we need to learn here, and they will stand us in good stead in eternity. But if you spend all your time trying to push the bumps out of the rug, you're going to be wasting your time, because when you push a bump out here, the bump comes out up somewhere else. You cure yellow fever and you get AIDS. You cure AIDS and you still got a cancer problem and what have you. So those are the limitations of mundane knowledge, whereas transcendental knowledge can solve all the problems of life. And we mentioned three general areas of suffering: adhyatmic, adhibhautik, adhidaivik. Suffering due to material nature like hurricanes, earthquakes, tornadoes. Suffering due to other living entities like terrorists trying to blow us up or bacteria trying to infect us with diseases. And then suffering due to our own body and mind. Now, modern science and modern medicine is trying to address the superficial symptoms of the suffering without getting to the root cause. There are two types of medicine. One is called homeopathy and one is called allopathy. homeopathy, in medical terms, tries to get to the root cause. It sees suffering and pain as a signal from the body that your lifestyle is not right. And so, rather than just addressing the symptom or covering the symptom, which is the thrust of allopathy, homeopathy tries to make those adjustments in your lifestyle, diet, exercise. Some foods are good for certain personality types. Some foods are to be avoided. There's vata, pitta, and vayu, three different personality types. Exercise. And then when one is living right, one shouldn't have to be assailed by various kinds of diseases. Mostly, Western knowledge, Western scientific advancement addresses the superficialities rather than the problems itself. And I think we saw these slides last week. You know, rather than saying, well, what is the cause of old age? What is the cause of old age? We cover it up. We try and cover it up. We try and deal with white hair by using hair dye, wrinkles on our face by using a facelift. We're sick, we're throbbing, we're aching in every bone in our body. And rather than think, disease or what bacteria have I contacted, how have I left myself open, maybe by being too sedentary or not washing my hands enough or not getting enough sunlight or eating too much or eating too little or not eating the right foods. Rather than thinking those terms, to go and remove the cause of the pain, we just take an aspirin or painkiller. And it's interesting that Utah is the number one abuser of prescription drugs. And these are drugs that people went to for a legitimate reason, but then they became so addicted to the superficial treatment of the symptoms that they gave up all hope of ever getting healthy again, and they're just going through life in sort of a dull, drugged state of mind. Now, I don't know no more about this guy this week than I did last week. And we told the story of the lady who separated her beauty. So here's where we begin, having left off from last week. Someone has a boil, and the superficial solution is take some cream and spread it on the boil. The problem with that is that the boil keeps recurring. The permanent solution is to take a blood purifier. Here it mentions an injection. Turmeric is an excellent blood purifier. Turmeric or neem. Neem is a very bitter, pungent, gross. Neem trees are all over India, and someone once described a neem tree as the village pharmacy. It's bitter, it's antiseptic, and you probably used to take twigs of neem and use them to brush his teeth with. It would kill all the germs, kill all the gingivitis. Then the neem solution would come down and kill all the bacteria and promote digestion. Another benefit of neem is when you live in a tropical country, the neem, when you take neem, it makes your skin taste bitter. And what does that do? What does that protect you from? When your skin tastes bitter, yeah, mosquitoes don't like to bite you. And I also discovered, too, it's an appetite suppressant as well. And when you go to India, you want to eat about half of what you eat in America. If you eat in India like you eat in America, you'll definitely get sick because there's a lot more bacteria in the food in India. And so we're used to dealing with a certain amount of bacteria. But if we overdose, then we'll get sick. It's not that we get sick from bacteria. It's that we get sick from too much bacteria. And so if you eat half of what you eat in India as you eat here, your system will be able to deal with the same amount of bacteria. But if you eat what you eat, if you eat in India, the amount of food you eat here, your system will be overloaded, and I guarantee you'll get sick. And I can't tell you how many people that I've given that advice to, and they've gone to India and just totally ignored it and gotten sick. Sick like a dog, like walking down the street, and I have got to run behind this wall. Will you excuse me a moment? You know, and then, I told you so. So in the case of a boil, you want to purify your blood, and then the boil will never recur. The wise believes in God, lives life according to the laws of God, remembers the temporary nature of this world, follows a regulative life of principles to ultimately attain God. The foolish has no faith in God, follows eat, drink, and be merry philosophy, forgets the temporary nature of this world, and enjoys sinfully not caring for the future. Envious of others, lives an unregulated life at the cost of others. See, this temporary world is in order to gain the eternal world. And if you can resist the temporary pleasures, but not resist, but control them, regulate them. If you can sleep regulatedly and eat regulatedly, it doesn't mean not to eat. It doesn't mean not to eat, but it means not to eat too much. It means not to eat too little. It doesn't mean not to sleep, but not to sleep too much or not to sleep too little. 6-7 hours or so of sleep. Eat twice a day, moderately. Don't eat late at night. These are all ways of regulating our intake, our sense gratification. And if we can not get carried away by it, not get dazzled by it, and be putting stuff in our mouth right and left, and then getting all overindulged and sleeping 12 hours a day, if we can control things and not be swept away by all that Maya has to offer us, then we will qualify for a never-ending life after leaving this present body. But obviously, we become totally sold out to the various temporary allurements and pleasures, then we identify with matter rather than with spirit. And identifying with spirit doesn't mean to pursue matter in all of its forms. It just means to live a regulated life. Because after all, as long as we've got this body, we do have an obligation to maintain it and keep body and soul together. I know I'm not the car, but that doesn't mean I can't oil it and service it and make sure it runs nicely for me. So these are some of the differences between the foolish and the faithful people. Foolish person, he knows that he will die today or tomorrow. Wait a minute. Knows that he will die today or tomorrow. He knows that everything is temporary, yet he is mad after short-lived pleasures of life. That's basically what I just said. This is a typical Indian train. And I guess he just died, didn't he? And so did he. Boy, they're just getting knocked off like that, right and left, you know? One minute you see them, and 1 minute they're gone. I'm not sure what this picture denotes either. It's a cow, and someone's delivered him. No, it's a goat. And the caption is, "Good day, so much grass, I am so lucky." And then I guess the next moment, yep, he's gone too. Jivana, Kamala. See if the guy lasts through the next slide. The duty of every man is to make relevant inquiries about the following questions. I guess the point is that right in the midst of desiring for sense gratification, death comes, taps us on the shoulder, and yanks us out of here. You know? Right in the middle of all of our plan making for enjoying the things of this world, death comes and just grabs us by the back of the neck and it's all over in a second. And yet we know that's going to happen. We know that's happened to our father, our grandfather, great-grandfather, great-great-grandfathers. We know that at any given moment, at any given second throughout the universe, there are millions of living entities being yanked just like that. Time's up. Go. They're going to the abode of Yamaraj. They're going to be judged. Their karma is going to be tabulated. They're going to get another birth. That's happening just like that. Million living entities went to Yamaraj. Million living entities. Million living. Million living. Million living. Think about it. And yet, foolish people are still trying to squeeze some enjoyment out of this material world, even though they know their time can come at any moment and they have to leave. So it's the duty of every man to make relevant inquiries about the following questions. Who am I? Am I this body, which is a bag of flesh and bones, or am I something superior? Who is God? How can I know Him? How did He create this world? What is His purpose in sending me here? What is my relationship with Him? What am I supposed to do? What is right and what is wrong? Why am I suffering is another question. Everybody, that's natural. You know, the animal might stand out in the rain. Sometimes the llamas, sometimes they'll go and get in and out when it's raining. Sometimes there'll be just a little sprinkle and they'll all run for the barn. And sometimes you'll come out and it'll be a downpour and they're all sitting out there in a downpour. And I honestly can't figure it out. But I think it has to do with something like they're not being able to ask this question, why am I suffering? The barn is over there and I'm sitting here in a down, and there's water dripping off my eyelashes and my nose and everything. And I think the only reason I think the living entity would do that is because they're not really asking the question, why am I suffering? And what is the cause of suffering? What is the remedy? What should be avoided in my life to surpass suffering? What all should I do in my life to surpass suffering? And why did God create suffering for us in the first place? Is there a purpose for suffering? And is there a way we can deal with it in order to get profit? Are sufferings lampposts? Are they mileposts on the way? And if they are, what are they mileposts on the way to? Where are we supposed to go in life? I don't really like all these transitions. That's why on my Sunday slides, they just come. They don't do all these little bleep, 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 bleep. Because it for me, it interferes with the rhythm of the presentation. You kind of have to wait like a beat or two. So we're just waiting here while these little captions come in, and I'm not sure. I guess the point of all these slides, which took like, 37 seconds to download onto one frame, is that people are going, but they don't know where they're going. They're going here and there, but they just don't know where they're going. The text here is aimless, fast-paced, rat-race lifestyle, mindless of purpose for which we were sent here, which will only lead us downward. When Rabindranath Tagore went to England the first time, because England's not very wide, I think it's maybe only 100 miles wide at its, from east to west. And people were going like 100 miles an hour or 60, 70 miles an hour in one direction. And then they were even passed by cars that were going 60 and 70 miles an hour in the other direction. And he arrived from India and he thought, how do they stop from just going off into the ocean? They're going so fast and think the cars are going this way, just end up in the ocean. The cars this way would end up in the ocean. And the fellow that's going this way at 90 miles an hour is probably going in that direction for the same reason that this guy is going 90 miles an hour. And they cross each other in the process. So the actual destination, the company gives you a car to go home. You put petrol in the car, wash it, repair damaged parts. That's not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal is to use the car to return home. Similarly, this human body is given to us to purify our heart and return back to the Lord. You can eat food, bathe the body, and set right any disorders in the body by going to a doctor. But your ultimate goal, why God has given you a human body, is to inquire and go back home, back to Godhead. And this is the subject matter that Lord Krishna instructs Arjuna about in the Bhagavad Gita, the difference between the soul and the body. You might drive a Pontiac or a Chevy or a Jetta, but you don't introduce yourself as Mr. Pontiac, Miss Jetta, or Mr. Chevy. We drive the car. The car has a purpose, but at the same time, we know we're not the car. We're different from the car. We wear a shirt. We wear our shirt, and we change our shirts according to our tastes and according to the occasions, the social environments in which we're invited. The shirt may reflect our own mentality, our own taste, but at the same time, we're not the shirt. Similarly, this body is like a shirt that gets old, torn, and useless after some time. And then just like you change your shirt, you change your body also. Modern society is very much fixated on the body rather than the soul within. And that's like the example of the bird in the cage. Lady here in this frame, she's got a bird cage, very nice golden bird cage. But you'll notice that all of her attention is focused on the cage, while inside of the cage, the bird is dying for want of sustenance. She's missing the point here. The bird cage is only to house the soul. The bird cage is not a point in and of itself. So then this body is only meant for the purpose of getting us home, of taking us back to home, back to Godhead. It has no separate purpose in and of itself. So this lady, for some reason, she's seeing a purpose in the bird cage in and of itself, but it doesn't have a separate independent purpose other than housing the bird. And the purpose of the bird cage is null and voided if the bird dies. If the bird dies. She's a nutcase. I mean, anyone would look at her and say, this lady is a complete nutcase because she doesn't understand what's what. Hear the story of Maha Morka from your teacher. I don't know what that is. I have no idea what that is. So there are three purposes of Vedas. And they're called Sambandha, Abhideya, and Prayojana. Sambandha is the initial stage of inquiry. which we can only do in the human form of life. The animals don't make these kinds of inquiries. They're not capable of it. And if you're a human being and you don't make this inquiry, then if you have a human body and you don't make it, you're not still human. You're only human by virtue of the consciousness which inquires into the nature of God and the nature of the self. And then when you begin to practice, you inquire, you try to lead a more spiritual life. You read spiritual literatures instead of fiction, and you look at spiritual videos instead of Hollywood pap, and you read scriptures, and you try to be more conscious about what you put in your body and what you eat, and you try to fill your heart up with good things, then that's abhideya. That means you're putting into practice the higher consciousness of being different from this body, and you're reviving your relationship with God. And then prayojana is like, it's the fruit. It's the fruit of good living. The fruits of good living, of righteous living, are peacefulness, happiness, compassion, purity. These are the fruits of someone who lives a pious life. And they're fruits which are cultivated over a long period of time. On Sunday, we talked about the example of the agriculturalist. Two farmers plant their field, and a week later, there's no difference. There's no difference between the two fields. There's nothing there. But 6 or 8 weeks later, now I can look out from where I'm standing. I see a whole new garden area is green. The plants in the other garden are knee high. And we're warned by Hanuman and Wendy, get ready, get ready. You know, there's a period of frantic activity of tilling and removing rocks and planting and sowing. And then a while, it's kind of quiet. It's just the lull before the storm. Everything's going to come, and it's going to come all at once. So we're all going to be out there picking away, you know, the pickaninnies in the Krishna's garden like that. And we're going to be getting peppers and cucumbers and carrots and melons and all kinds of stuff is going to come, and it's all going to come at once. So that way we're enjoying the mature fruit. Now, the farmer that didn't plant anything, he gets nothing. After a week, he could say, well, look, you did all that work for nothing. I didn't do any work, and I got the same result you did. But he's going to have to eat his words 8 weeks later when you've got more than you need, and he's got nothing. So cultivation, getting the answers and enjoying the fruits of pious life is an extended process. It's not a quick fix. It's not an overnight thing. And these are analogously compared to three stages in a marriage. The sambandha stage, in traditional India, the bride wouldn't have known or met her husband before they were married 100 years ago. And but she would know how to act. She would know the formalities. She would know the etiquette. She would know what it means to be a bride, what are the responsibilities, as he would know what it means to be a husband. But there would be a formality there, because they didn't know each other. And she would go, the wedding ceremony would take place in the bride's home, and after the wedding ceremony, she would go to the groom's home. And she'd never left. She'd been up under the protection of her father and her older brothers up until that point in time. And when she would go to the groom's home, she'd often take a number of her girlfriends with her, just because she would have someone that she would feel comfortable with. And then when she gets to the groom's home, it's all stiff and formal. You know, it's very polite, very cordial. There's every expectation and anticipation of a deep, warm, loving, lifelong relationship, but it's not something you get overnight. It just doesn't happen. But they know how to act. They know what their duties are. So they go about their business very formally, very politely, very cordially, but the oil isn't there yet. You see what I'm saying? It's not yet spontaneous. After doing that for some, and there's no physical contact, there's no like honeymoon, you know what I'm saying, in this scenario. And after some time, it may take months, it may take a year, it may take more than a year, finally they become friends. They actually start to really like each other. They know what the other one's thinking. They anticipate their needs, and they start working not as two people doing a choreography, but more like one person. They become more in unison, and their hearts beat as one, and they become friends. And then that's when physical intimacy comes about. Then, after the physical intimacy takes place, 9 months later, or whenever the lady conceives, then they have a child. But it proceeds through those three stages: the formal stage, the relaxing stage, the natural stage where things come naturally, a second nature, you don't have to think about them. And then, as a result, there's a fruit, which is a baby, a love child. You might, I think they use that term in a different context. A true love child, you know, the product of true love. See what I'm saying? That was a lust child. This is a real love. This is how you get a love child. So love of God also progresses through those three stages. The instructional part of it, the formal part of it, originates with the Vedas, wherein Lord Krishna appeared before Lord Brahma, the creator of the universe, and he instructed the principles of Sambandha, the answers to the questions, who am I, who is God, what am I here for, and what's the purpose of this? And then that knowledge passed down in disciplic succession, Krishna to Brahma, Brahma to Narada, and so on, down Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, and to our spiritual master, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, who brought it to the Western countries. I don't know, there's nothing in that slide. It's just advanced knowledge in the Vedas. So why should we accept the axioms of the Vedas, which are unproven, at least not empirically? Well, there's no science without axioms. Radhisham is a real scientist, and so he knows these terms a lot better than I do. He has a much more working familiarity. Imaginary number, conceptual methods, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, third law of thermodynamics. There are certain things which you cannot experience or even prove, but when you take them as an axiom and you work with them as an axiom, then you can predict things that happen, even though you cannot prove the axiom itself. But the axiom proves itself, because when you act as if that was true, things happen predictably. And so that's one of the reasons that we accept the Vedas, is because it works. It works. If we adopt the paradigms and life views of the Vedas, the result is that we actually get answers to questions, and things work, and we actually begin to work effectively in the material nature, in the material context, in order to solve the ultimate problems of life. So here's scientific theories, and in Aristotle, 360 BC, he said matter is continuous with particles in contact. That was his theory. Boyle in the 17th century said dynamic entities separated by space. These are all different, I guess, trying to wrestle with the concept of matter. Dalton in the 19th century formulated atomic theory, and he said atoms are indivisible. Rutherford in the 20th century said atoms contain electrons and protons surrounding. None of this anyone has ever seen, by the way. But you see, one thing builds on another, and you get knowledge. You get truth evolving through this. And then matter has properties of waves, and then you get the wave mechanical formula by Schrodinger in 1926. So there are certain things which, for instance, if you postulate that I'm this body, and you work on that principle, nothing works. It's temporary, it's frustrating and miserable. If you postulate based on the truths of the Vedas, I'm a soul, it all works, even though you've never seen the soul yourself. You've never seen the soul. So the Vedas present absolute truth, which never changes. The theories don't change. They're fixed, they're eternal, and they're axiomatic. 5,000 years ago, they were true. 500 years ago, they were true. And 50 years ago, they were true. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Krishna, as well as Prabhupada, they're all enumerating the same basic truths, which are undefeatable, and they don't change as well. And if you consult the teachings of the great souls, there are so many commonalities like that. The Vedas themselves have predicted the birth of Buddha thousands of years before he was born. They predicted, there's actually mention of Lord Jesus Christ in some parts of the Atharva Vedas. Here it's quoted here. Mohammed in the Bhuvisha, Christ, actually Mohammed are mentioned in the Bhuvisha Purana, the Atharva Veda, Kanda 20, Sukta 127. Uncanny predictions, uncanny truths from the Vedas. Vedas said thousands of years ago that plants have life. And that was only proved recently by Jagadish Chandra Bose. He put electric nodes on the plants and threatened them, and they screamed. They screamed out of fear and terror. The Vedic scriptures also say that the cow dung is pure. In some places, the Vedas say that dung is impure. If you touch dung, you have to immediately take a shower. You certainly can't cook or do anything like that after having touched dung. But at the same time, it says that you can smear your house with cow dung. It'll insulate it, and it'll kill germs. And if there's nothing else at hand, you have a cut, you can put some pure cow dung on it, and it'll act in an antiseptic way. Science has recently verified that. But in the Vedas, it was said thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. Description of human embryology in the scriptures matches modern-day medical research. There I'm just talking about. In 1940, the scientists found the antiseptic qualities of cow dung. Modern man, the very same things that were extolled in the Vedas. We're going to have a yoga class here. We're not going to have a yoga class here because no one showed up, but we have a yoga class scheduled every Tuesday night. In fact, Ram, I think, is the teacher. I was going to take it just to sort of encourage him. So modern man has turned to yoga, meditation, vastu. So many people now are building their houses and laying their houses out according to the ancient Vedic system of vastu to create good vibrations in the house. Astronomy, astrology, metallurgy from the Vedas. So this is the example that you use, and you've heard me say it before, about the authority of the Vedas. Let's say you're born, but your father left, and he's never seen you. You've never seen your father. Your father impregnated your mother, but before you were born, he had to leave on a business trip, or maybe he's in the army, and he's never seen you before. You've never seen him. And one day, you're maybe 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years old, a man walks in, and he says, "I'm your dad." How do you know? You can't verify it. You cannot touch him, taste him, smell him, see him. None of that will prove without a doubt that this man who claims to your father is your father. He could be lying. He could be mistaken. He may mistake you for somebody else. Now, the only way to tell for sure is ask your mother. So the Vedas are like the mother, and they give the authoritative answer of who it is, who is our procreator, our progenitor, who it is, the father. And in fact, we say mother nature. A woman cannot produce a child independently. There must be the agency of the father. So nature does not produce life independently any more than a woman produces a child independently. There must be the agency of the father. So it's the mother who can tell us authoritatively who the father is. Amen. We will check your genes and tell you who your father is in 800 years. Medical tests by genetic fingerprint takes 800 years to identify a lot of 200 men, one of whom is likely to be your father. That's inductive knowledge, a very drawn-out, time-consuming process. But you can find out exactly through the gene pool and through scientific experiment, in 800 years you can find out who your father is. That's inductive knowledge. But if you want to know in an instant who your father is, just ask your mother, and she'll tell you. And that's called deductive knowledge. This is what I was explaining. The Vedas compared to our mother, God is the father, and the Vedas can guide us to our supreme father. So, this is the last slide, actually. The Vedic process of learning, the professors are the gurus, one who have heard from their teachers and their acharyas and have modeled righteous, spotless, stainless behavior. The college is the parampara, or the succession, by which the Vedic knowledge is passed down to us, teacher to student, to student to the super student, in a line of civic succession, and the authorized books of the Vedic texts like the Bhagavad Gita. So in any academic or any institution of learning, you have professors, you have a college, and you have standard books of knowledge. So these are the Vedic elements in our education. Professors are not just the ones who speak from the ears up, not just the ones who have academic knowledge. They have knowledge, but they also model perfect behavior. They are the embodiment of the scriptures. They are the person Bhagavad. And then the college is the parampara, or the disciplic session, and then the authorized books of the Vedic texts like the Bhagavad Gita. and those make up the various elements of our educational system by which we answer in the human form of life the question of who am I, where have I come from, what is the purpose of life, where am I going, why am I suffering, and how can I eliminate suffering once and for all. Thank you very much. Thank you.